You're listening to the GP Supervision Australia podcast, Culturally Safe GP Registrar Supervision, Decolonisation and a Strengths-Based Approach, presented by Dr. Karen Nichols, Dr. Tyrone Clayworth and Dr. Simon Morgan. We would like to begin by acknowledging the traditional custodians of the land on which this recording was produced and pay our respects to their elders past, present, future and their families.
My name's Ty Clayworth and the first thing I'd like to do is to acknowledge country. So I'm coming to you from a Awabakal country here in Newcastle, and I'd like to pay my respects to traditional custodians of Awabakal country and also for my fellow panelists and presenters tonight. And I'd also like to extend that respect to any Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people joining us. So I'll just give a quick introduction, but I'm a GP here in Newcastle, and I also work with the RACGP as one of the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander regional MEs. And I work with Simon and Jess locally, looking after registrars in Newcastle region as well.
As Ty said, my name's Simon Morgan. I'm the education manager with GPSA. I'm a GP and medical educator here in Newcastle.
Welcome, everyone. My name is Karen Nichols. I'm a Torres Strait Islander woman. I'm on Worimi country, which is just a neighbour to Awabakal country around Newcastle. I'd like to pay my respects to the elders past, present and emerging. And I'm going to try and get through as much of this content on time as possible. It is quite a lot of information, and some of it may be new, some of it may be challenging, some of it may make you feel a little bit uncomfortable. I would just actually really ask you to sit with that discomfort and just consider the information that's being presented. So this talk is actually conceptual. It is about decolonizing the approach to general practice registrar education, and we're hoping to introduce some other concepts such as strengths-based approach to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health rather than the deficit discourse that tends to surround Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health. We also want to help you understand that there is bias in Australia when it comes to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, and that can actually impact type and quality of care that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people may be receiving, and hopefully give you a little bit more confidence to be able to teach some of the nuances in Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health that aren't the biomedical parts that most of you are actually really, really fantastic at. So in order for us to understand Aboriginal health, and I'm using Aboriginal health when I'm referring to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, I'm not in any way intending on being disrespectful. But for us to understand Aboriginal health and to become culturally aware and culturally safe practitioners, we need to actually understand the foundations and the context of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health. And that's based in colonisation. We all have different levels of knowledge of Aboriginal history. Some of us have quite a lot, and some of us have not as much, but we have some foundational knowledge. And what we know about Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander history in Australia is based on the information that we've been receiving from either our educational institutions, from the media, from the people that we socialise with. So understanding where you get your knowledge from with regards to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, culture, history, ways of knowing, being and doing is really, really important. Unfortunately, a lot of what has been taught in the past has been about a deficit. And when we've talked about Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, it's been more within the context of populations that need saving. That actually means that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people have been seen as a problem to be solved, would be another way to present how Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people have been thought about in the past. So what we're wanting to do is we're wanting to actually invite you to consider that there's actually strengths within Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities that perhaps we are better off being aware of, and actually changing the way in which we think about Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health. To just remind you that there is a lot of diversity, and when I'm talking about Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, I'm talking about a huge number of different countries, and we're talking 250 language groups with over 800 dialects. So it's quite a large population in terms of diversity. And at the moment, as of 2021, we made up about 3.8% of the total population, and the number of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people are increasing quite quickly. So I just want you to reflect on how confident you feel when it comes to teaching Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health. And this would be the sort of stuff, the sort of things that we would expect you to be able to teach a registrar. So that does include the local historical context, understanding how colonisation has impacted the local population that you work within, what the values are, so the values of respect, obligation, reciprocity, holistic health and being a collective society, what does that mean? The cultural protocols that may be there, welcome to country, acknowledgement of country, appropriate titles, who do you call auntie, who do you call uncle? Clinical yarning and the three components of clinical yarning being social, diagnostic and management yarning. Are you able or do you feel confident in sharing that knowledge or imparting that knowledge on your registrar? And then the impacts of things such as intergenerational trauma, what social emotional wellbeing means for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, the systemic barriers and enablers of good health, what are they? And racism and prejudice and how that impacts. And I think disease disparity is there. We know that and we can easily find those numbers. And that's often what is thought of as being Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health. But it's actually far more broad than that. I often get asked, you know, why do we need to learn about Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health? Shouldn't we be doing this for everyone? And the answer to that question is yes. But we do need to understand the context that everyone comes from. So whilst there's broad principles around this that are applicable to other groups such as populations with disability or LGBTQIA+, I cannot speak to those communities, and it would actually be far more respectful for us to ensure that those communities have fair representation and a voice where they can actually present the perspective that is important for them. I wouldn't begin to speak on their behalf. So the principles, the guiding principles, are really important, and things like trauma-informed care is what is applicable to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health and also applicable to other groups that are disenfranchised or marginalised.
Karen, I might interrupt just because we've got a very pertinent question from Peter Silverberg, who is a friend and colleague up in North Coast. Just that notion of a non-Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander supervisor talking with any sense of credibility or appropriateness, I guess, around cultural values, cultural protocols, those sorts of things. Yeah, just he's asked that question directly.
Yeah. So you can, as a supervisor, point to how important it is to know that. And what you could do is actually direct the registrar to resources that have been developed by Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. And hopefully there might be some resources local to your area. But that's what you can do. It's the role modelling that you do by saying, actually, this is really important for you to know. And this is where I would urge you to go and look and research it.
Thanks, Karen. It's probably very different in different parts of the country, right? And depending on where you work. And I don't think those points are very simple. And some of the complexities for me personally are where I work is that even as a doctor who's been at my organisation for a long time, those things haven't even really been sat down and talked to me. And the capacity for the organisation to be able to deliver, I mean, that just might be my personal experience, but I think that requires some discussion because it's just not always that available in Aboriginal medical services that you can just get that sort of information very easily or that it's readily given to you.
Point noted, like definitely, and point taken. The registrar should have access to a cultural mentor. I know in some of the areas they're looking at more localised cultural mentors as well. So this is actually something that may evolve and become a bit more readily available for trainees as they go through their training. But I'll hand over to Ty because he'll definitely have something valuable to share on this.
Thanks, Karen. And thanks for the question, Peter. I think from a like supervisor point of view, if your registrar, in terms of passing that on to your registrar, whether they be an ACRM registrar or an RACGP registrar, it's called the Joint College Training Services, which employs cultural mentors. So they're not doctors, they're Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people working as cultural educators and mentors. And they're sort of allocated to each of the different sub-regions. So in New South Wales, there's six. And then myself and I've got a colleague, Josie, are both doctors, and we also work for RACGP, not for JCTS, so we don't look after ACRM. But if you had registrars who are asking some of these questions, part of the role of those cultural mentors and cultural educators to do site visits and have links with different AMSs and ACHs and different people and communities across the state. So I was chatting with a couple of them last Friday who'd done many site visits in northern New South Wales. So I think that's a really good resource if you had a registrar and you kind of were wanting to help them to learn, because I think on their journey through, that is put in place so that they can access it. I take what you mentioned about the local historical context, because rightly so, that should come from, you know, local people within that country. And that won't always be able to happen. But I think for some of those other points, you know, Aboriginal cultural values and cultural protocols, that's definitely what that's there to help facilitate for registrars.
Thanks, Ty and Karen. I just make very quickly the point that, as the old quip goes, history is written by the victors often. And so even those historical contexts that we might be feeling is valid, and that gets to the whole point of this, I think, about decolonizing what we teach. We probably have to challenge even those very basic historical facts, which may be underpinned by sort of racist and biased values. I'll let you carry on though, I think, Karen.
Yep, lovely. So just to remind people, we have bipartisan support for closing the gap. So that is why we focus and talk on Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health, because clearly closing the gap is not going to be successful without meeting health targets. It is important to note that when closing the gap started, there was no real Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander input into what those targets will be. And it wasn't until the last iteration of it where there's been some changes to the targets and the addition of some priority areas that we are hoping that we will see more change with outcomes, because that's been led and driven by Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, and that's through the peak organisations, health organisations such as NACHO. I just wanted to remind you, colonisation is the cause of the burden of disease that we see. The social determinants of health are a result of the colonisation, and it's a result of the inequities that have occurred over the last 200 years or so, the oppression, the policies, and those unjust policies and historical events that have occurred just purely because people were Indigenous. Now, none of this is about making anyone feel guilty. It is just, this is Australia's history, and it's just understanding that this is part of who we are. But remembering the social determinants of health are linked with education, incarceration, employment, housing, social inclusion or social exclusion, depending, and that includes the impact of racism. So one of the things that we would like you to do is actually consider your own biases, to be able to understand how you teach and where your worldview comes from and your lens in which you see the world. You need to be able to unpack whether or not you have any biases. And that can be quite confronting and uncomfortable for some people. But if you're feeling that discomfort, that's an opportunity for growth and for learning and development and understanding of yourself. So just being mindful of that. A reminder of the policy areas, if you like, to a certain point. I haven't included the more recent ones, but, you know, dispossession, the conflict of protection and assimilation. So protection and assimilation is where the policies that came about moving to people to missions, it was about smoothing the dying pillow, assimilation, that, you know, those policies saw a lot of our children being taken away, and that was quite a long formal policy. It still happens today, but in a different way. But the structures which are responsible for those policies still exist. And so we need to think about, how do we actually challenge those structures? And self-determination. More modern policies that have had a significant impact are things like the Northern Territory intervention, the Black Deaths in Custody reports, the Bringing Them Home reports, the things that have not been acted on. So it's worthwhile just keeping those in the back of your mind. Again, it's not about blame, it's just keeping it in the back of your mind. Allostatic load. So what happens when you have people that are stressed and generation after generation feel that trauma? That trauma is passed on, and it's passed on through what is called allostatic load. And this leads to hormonal and nervous dysfunction. So you get release of stress hormones, you get as a result of that changes to people's physiology. And there are actually studies which show, research that demonstrates, that there are changes to people's genome and genetics. And this has been studied. This is not unique to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander experiences. Holocaust survivors and their descendants have been shown to have greater chronic disease because of allostatic load. Children, a study by Andrew Curry in 2019, looked at children living in orphanages in Pakistan who'd been separated from their parents, and despite having been given really good support and education, they suffered from symptoms which were similar to PTSD, and it was purely from the emotional trauma of being separated from parents. So I think it's really important that we start to understand that chronic stress, chronic experiences of racism, actually add to people's allostatic load. So if we think about Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander patients who are sick and wanting to go to a hospital that has a reputation for not delivering good care for an Aboriginal person, the stress hormones go up again. And so it just contributes to this cycle. And again, at the end of this talk, I have two studies. One is by Juanita Sherwood, an Aboriginal nurse who has written about the impacts of colonization and how it is bad for health. And the other one is a colleague of mine, Karen Menzies, who's a fantastic social worker. I suggest you Google her because she's actually Australia's first Aboriginal Matilda back in the 80s, and she's pretty awesome. But she actually talks about the concept of collective historical and intergenerational trauma in relation to those trauma-informed frameworks. So they're not long articles, but they're actually really quite informative. What I thought we might do is we might actually look at some of the health conditions that Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people have high incidence of. So we'll look at the burden of disease, but we might actually look at it a little bit more with a strengths-based lens. So I'm going to talk about these, and these are things that you're probably already aware of. If we look to something like ear health, we know that recurrent infections is associated with the social determinants of health, social disadvantage, overcrowded housing conditions, inadequate access to clean water and functional sewage systems, and tobacco and nutritional problems, and poor access to primary health care. Otitis media is most commonly seen as the ear health issue, and it's 8.5 times higher in Aboriginal children than in non-Indigenous children. And the rate of chronic suppurative otitis media in Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children in the Northern Territory sits around the 12 to 15% at the moment. So that's actually quite high. You know, if we were to compare it to non-Indigenous populations, which I'm not going to do, but if we were, it's substantially higher than non-Indigenous populations. But let's look at the starting point of this. Well, it wasn't the starting point, but not so long ago, the rates in the Territory was 24%. So the rates are coming down. It is improving. It still remains a public health emergency, but there is improvement. So there are programs and there are things being done out there that are actually having a positive impact on this. We want to know, we want to be able to present what those programs are, how people are getting such good outcomes, to see whether or not those are things that we can replicate. The point of presenting that is to ensure that people don't, and by people I mean doctors, don't feel so disempowered and overwhelmed by the problem. And I know when I teach this to medical students, they feel overwhelmed by what do I do? They feel powerless in this space. So, you know, 12 to 15% is high. It was higher. So we want to do more of whatever it is we're doing that's working. And I'll come to one of those other ones a little bit later. But I'm hoping that gives you a sense of what a strengths-based approach would be. And the deficit discourse is the numbers and the comparison of Indigenous versus non-Indigenous, when we're at totally different starting points, so we can't compare the two really. But the strengths-based is going, well, actually, there are things that are working. These are the things that promote positive health or better health. Now, I'm going to move on to bias, the Harvard Implicit Association Test. When I did mine, I surprised myself quite a bit, which is a little bit confronting, but it's worthwhile. You know, if you want to improve, you've got to do things that will help you improve. Now, it's to look at unconscious bias. Unconscious bias is an attitude, an assumption, or a belief that implicitly influences our thinking. And it's usually really rapid thinking. We're not actually really conscious of it. We have these biases without actively thinking about them or even knowing that we hold them. So that implicit association test was done over a 10-year period looking at Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, looking at Aboriginal people, and was specifically testing the Australian population. The information, the data on that study was published in 2019. And what they found was that 3 in 4 people hold negative views of Indigenous Australians. So 75% of the 11,000 people who participated in the study in Australia on whether or not they hold bias towards Aboriginal people, 75% of people did. Now, that doesn't mean that they are bad people. It means that they hold negative views. It also means that they may have been aware or they may not have been aware. It also means that it provides them an opportunity to reflect on what their views are and what has informed their views. So there is a chance that 75% of the people hold negative views of Aboriginal or Indigenous Australians. So how might that be impacting the quality of your care? How might that be impacting the way in which you teach Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health to your registrar? What sort of language are you using without realising that you are perpetuating a deficit discourse or that you are speaking in a way that is not inclusive of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people? I'll just leave you with that. Quite an interesting exercise for, you know, doctors and medical students and nursing students and people in health to do.
Yeah, I think that notion of sitting with this and just doing a test, maybe like the Harvard Implicit Association test, but just questioning one's own beliefs can be hugely revealing. And obviously in the context of supervisors and registrars, inviting the registrar to do the same thing.
Thank you, Simon. I'm happy to provide lots of studies that show that, and it's about access issues, not just about the interpersonal racism that we see that is the ugly stuff, but the stuff that is, you know, shared on social media. It's the access, it's the referral. So if we're even looking at something as simple as renal transplant rates for a population that has a large percentage of the burden of disease when it comes to end-stage kidney disease, why do we not have higher renal transplant rates? So, you know, access to joint replacements, it's the same sort of thing. Less likely to be referred for joint replacements, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people are. So there is lots of examples that I can provide, but I just want to also remind you that Indigeneity is a socio-cultural practice. Aboriginality, being a Torres Strait Islander, it's a cultural thing, was always a cultural thing. It's just that people look different on the outside. And by different, I mean they have a different skin colour. Policies have then meant that we have fairer skinned Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. It does not make them any less Indigenous. So just bearing in mind that we can take away someone's identity by voicing our view that they do not fulfil what we expect they should look like. So just being really mindful of that. And I say that as someone who has 3 children and one who's very fair-skinned, like really fair-skinned, but she is no less Torres Strait Islander. She is accepted by our community and loved and cherished by our community. To point out and remember that people that you are seeing are not just descendants of the policies of the past, but also people who were deep and embedded within those policies in the past, so stolen generation members. So even someone who is as young as 57 is someone who was part of that stolen generation. So just being mindful of that. The concepts with decolonising Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health, deficit discourse, which I'll provide a definition for, the strengths-based approach, which we'll talk a little bit more about, critical reflection, and critical reflection is about looking at your own bias. So I'm hoping that you will start on that journey after doing the Harvard Implicit Association test, or if you haven't done it, you will go and do it. A trauma-informed approach, which I'm fairly sure is something that many of you would have heard of or even be familiar with, and an anti-racist praxis. And trauma-informed, I will go back to, because trauma-informed care and a trauma-informed approach is defined by the impact that an experience has had on an individual rather than the experience itself. So I think that's something that you need to make sure you remember. It's defined by the impact that that experience has had. The core principles of that, which again is applicable to every single patient that walks through the door, trust, that you create an environment of trust, you create a safe space, that the patient feels free to make a choice, and that you provide all options for them to be able to make a choice, that decision making is collaborative, that you are empowering the patient, so you are handing over the power balance in that consultation to the patient, and that you also respect that there's diversity. So one patient who comes in, one Aboriginal patient from the same community, will have a different experience and may actually choose a different path to another member from that same community. There are some tools that you can use for critical reflection, Carl and the 4Fs, but I'll go through a couple of those shortly. So decolonizing, what do we mean by decolonizing? Well, we mean thinking about who writes the documents, who writes the history, who's written it, whose perspective are you hearing, and acknowledging that that perspective is never unbiased, it's never impartial, it is always got a lens that's been put over that, and that a lot of what we have learned in the past is information that has not been through the lens of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander perspectives, especially when it comes to health and well-being. So that's really important to remember. If we look at something like pregnancy care, you know, for a long time, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander women have wanted to have birthing practices that were in line with their cultural values, and that has not been afforded within the health system in which we work. So there are now programs that are coming out that are actually showing much better health outcomes, and we'll talk about that shortly, when the cultural umbrella is put over the care of our pregnant women who are either Aboriginal women or women who are giving birth to Aboriginal children. To also point out, it is not a rejection of Western knowledge or ideology. We can't do that, but it's how do we center Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander and Indigenous knowledges and concerns and worldview. And some of you may be doing that very well. Some of you may be doing that very well indeed. A Lowitja document that Ty kindly shared. It was a great read. And it looked at some of the strengths-based approaches and some of the key elements and the studies that you can look up to see and have a look at what that involves. And some of those I think we probably do reasonably well as GPs and teach these to our registrars reasonably well. If we look at things like asset-based, so what are the strengths in the person or the community? But, you know, when you're looking at Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health, just remembering when you're teaching it to your registrar, it's holistic. So the components of the strengths need to come from all of those. So culture needs to come from connection to country, connection to kin. So all of those that you would, I'm hoping you remember that, social, emotional well-being. Resilience, you know, I think, again, resilience we probably tap into, but for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, it's a bit more around the emotional and the spiritual resilience, which is something that community has had to tap in more recently. So resilience, I'm actually seeing quite a lot of it. Despite everything, I think community is really generally caring for each other. Cultural appropriateness, I think we're all becoming more and more aware, and we just need far more tools in our toolbox to be able to direct registrars to. And the social determinants of health, and hopefully they've got that through medical school as well as through the GP training programs. So Gibbs reflective cycle, if you Google that, that's actually a simple way to go about reflecting on a situation and being able to reflect deeply rather than that real superficial reflection that you can fall into the trap of. So that's part of that critical reflection. Trauma informed, I've talked about, and the quote from a person with lived experience, which I think is really important, that it is recognizing that the symptoms are a response to trauma. Sometimes we can't ignore those symptoms, and we can't ignore the impact that trauma has. The case of you as a supervisor attending a training day on Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander health, at the beginning of the session, the medical educator talks about the importance of asking the patient the identifying question. So do you identify as Aboriginal and or Torres Strait Islander? A discussion from the floor occurs, and a colleague states that they don't ask the question, as they treat everyone the same. And another colleague states that they don't ask the question unless someone looks Aboriginal, as they don't want to offend anyone. I will just say these cases are actually real. That was stuff that happened when I was in a supervisor training, and I was right next to one of the doctors that said a couple of these statements. They said something else as well. And it was my first supervisor meeting ever. So I already had that imposter syndrome sort of firing quite a lot. And then to hear that, it made me feel even more unworthy of the space. Just to point out that we've discussed decolonization and that it recognizes that we bring our own lens to the world in which we engage, but it's not the only lens in which the world can be viewed. Strengths-based approach, changing our language and looking at what resources we can tap into that the community or a patient has. And also we've touched on bias and maybe hopefully discussed a little bit about anti-racism and how we might be able to start to enter that space instead of just being a person who is inclusive, but actually actively being anti-racist. It's a different mindset and a different challenge again. Now, there are some resources. There's the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Health in General Practice booklet, and there's a couple of lesson plans. Clinical Yarning, which is a tool I really, really strongly recommend you ask your registrars to complete. It's 2 hours, it's free resource, and it is very good, and it goes through what clinical yarning is and those three stages. And then there are some awesome odd podcasts, things like Ask the Specialist, which is just an awesome podcast on communication.
Is clinical yarning appropriate nationwide?
Yes, it's the actual principles of clinical yarning. It's definitely appropriate nationwide.
Thank you so much. I mean, you know, yes, it's a huge area. Yes, it's hard to do justice to such an important and conceptual and complex topic as this. But really, if it's raised your awareness, if it's nudged you in the direction of talking to your registrars, challenging your own biases and assumptions, caring for your patients in a more compassionate and culturally safe way, then we're thrilled. Thanks so much, Karen.
No worries. Thanks, everyone, for participating. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. We'd love your feedback. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, please give us a rating and or a review. And if you haven't already, please subscribe and share this podcast with your colleagues. If you'd like to ask a question or suggest a topic, you can reach out to us via our social channels. Simply search GP Supervision Australia on Facebook, LinkedIn, Instagram, or Twitter. GP Supervision Australia is supported by funding from the Australian Government under the Australian General Practice Training Program.